we're tired and scared. We've been walking for miles now. What little sleep we get is shattered by the sounds of war. It's not the whistles of the shells or the thunder of the bombs, but the children and their mothers cry for the ones they'll never see. For he could not believe his ears, he could not believe his eyes, his helpless child crying, "Daddy, come back," as they pushed him in the car. Just not fair, it's just not right. He'll never kiss her again goodnight. It seems the soldiers don't believe he has a right to hold her anymore. What we've seen here on this road is just too hard to comprehend. I know the other side has families separated just like us. And how does disagreement turn to rage? For what reason all is hatred? We all serve the same God who hurts to see his children fight. It's just not fair, it's just not right. Kiss your kids goodnight. Just imagine for a minute that you have no right to hold. And it's just not fair, it's just not right to never kiss your kids goodnight. Just imagine for a minute that you have no right to hold. And it's just not fair, it's just not right to never kiss your kids goodnight. Just imagine for a minute that you have no right to hold. And it's just not fair, it's just not right to never kiss or keep its good night. Just imagine for a minute that you have no right to hold. Your own children anymore. It's just not right. Oh no, not right. It's just not fair. Just not fair. Just not right. And it's just not right not to ever hold your kids at night.
Welcome. And thank you for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program is Lawrence Lessig interviews Jack Abramoff. Jack Abramoff is the former lobbyist who pleaded guilty in 2006 to charges of fraud, tax evasion, and conspiracy to bribe public officials. He's also worked as a businessman, movie producer, and writer. Abramoff's lobbying and the scandals and investigations are featured in a documentary movie, Casino Jack and the United States of Money, and in a political satire movie titled Casino Jack. Lawrence Lessig is a law professor at Harvard. He has been the lead counsel in important cases concerning copyright laws for digital content. His current work concerns institutional corruption. So take it away, Lawrence.
So welcome to the first of our new and occasional series, In the Dock. My name is Lawrence Lessig. I'm the director of the Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics and a professor here at the law school. And as I described this series when we announced it, our aim is to have a conversation with a wider range of souls than is typically on this stage. These are people with a different kind of experience, sometimes illegal experience, sometimes ethical experience. But of course, for such a conversation to make sense, these are also souls who have demonstrated a certain reflection, a certain ability to reflect upon what they know and what they've experienced in a way that would contribute to the work of this center. And so that plus the willingness to engage in a conversation that might advance our understanding of the ethical issues that are at the heart of our work. And so I'm extremely grateful tonight to Jack Abramoff that he has helped us launch this series, perhaps the perfect launch for the series. As everyone here knows, Jack Abramoff is America's most famous, perhaps infamous, lobbyist. In January 2006, he pled guilty to 3 federal criminal felony counts involving his work as a lobbyist. In the same month, he pled guilty to 2 felony criminal counts in Miami related to a casino venture. 2 years later, he was found guilty of exchanging gifts for favors. He was sentenced to up to 11 years for the full range of these counts that he pled or was convicted of. In June last year, he was transferred from a federal correctional institution to a halfway house in Baltimore. And a year ago, he was released on probation and now lives under the constant surveillance of our criminal system with a continuing obligation to pay whatever money he earns in restitution back to the government. Now, Jack's story has been told in the press and in the movies, including a documentary by Alex Gibney and a feature film starring Kevin Spacey. It must have been very cool to meet Kevin Spacey. And so it's been told again and again, and it's quite familiar to everybody. And if you're a junkie for this sort of stuff, as I am, after you read his extremely compelling account in his book Capital Punishment, which I think we have available downstairs, I think you'll experience a little bit of a Rashomon effect as you try to piece together exactly who did what when. But the conversation we're going to have tonight has nothing to do with that story or those stories. We're not here to relitigate the guilt or innocence of a lobbyist. We're here tonight to learn about the institution that he lobbied, Congress, and about the nature of the political system that he so successfully navigated. And it was my sense before I read the book and my conviction after I read his book that his experience has an enormous amount to teach us. And my aim in this conversation tonight is to walk through the aspects of that experience that might in fact inform. And so if we're successful, it will be in large part because we've had the chance to engage with a man who has had an extraordinary and diverse life. He's a committed and practicing Orthodox Jew who has made religion a central part and a central constraint on his life. There's a wonderful story in the book of him being summoned by Imelda Marcos to come meet Imelda Marcos, and she suggested 12 o'clock on Friday, and it turned out that was midnight on Friday, which of course meant he wasn't able to drive to the meeting, so he had to walk through the Philippines to the meeting space, which of course, if you've been to the Philippines late at night, this is not necessarily the best thing for a non-native to engage in, but this was the only way he could go through with a meeting that was to be held at midnight on Friday night. He was one of the key figures who revived the Republican Party in the early 1980s after graduating from Brandeis. No, one didn't think there were Republicans in Brandeis, but there were. In 1981, he became chairman of the College Republicans. At the very same time, I was the chairman of the Teenage Republicans of Pennsylvania, so I feel a certain kinship in a weird way here. He has been a film producer. He has been a restaurant owner, a philanthropist. Indeed, some report giving up to 80% of his income to various philanthropic causes. Indeed, and maybe the best summary of his character was his own, I think, hilarious summary of himself when he said, quote, "I was the powerlifting, football-playing, Orthodox Jewish, right-wing Republican opera buff." You know the type. So it's not easy to stand in the dock. There are not many who would do so voluntarily. But again, I am grateful to Jack that he would fling himself to Boston to engage in this conversation to help all of us understand a bit more a system that practically none of us respect. So Jack, thank you and welcome here tonight. So I want to begin the conversation by trying to get our bearings. And I was struck early in the book with two stories you tell, one which outraged you and the other which you passed over without really recognizing any problem. So the first one that outraged you was a story about Reagan trying to get his MX missile passed. And it's a story of you getting a telephone call from Congressman Bustamante, congressman from Texas. And as you recount in the book, you say, "Yes, sir, what can I do for you?" And Bustamante says, "The Defense Department is planning to place a new naval base in the Gulf of Mexico, and I want it for my district. I hear they are looking at Florida instead. If I get the base, you get the votes. If I don't, you don't get the votes. The votes are from my Hispanic caucus, and they are solidly in my control. What do you say? And you remark, this is your first moment, your first experience of true Washington corruption. That's it. And Bustamante, of course, later is convicted of various felonies and is sent to prison, so it's not implausible to say that corruption was in at least part of his soul. Okay. But I want you to put that story next to another story, which you tell early in the book, about the great Richard Gordon, who taught entertainment law at Georgetown. And he was great. I mean, he was an extraordinary professor. But you tell the story about trying to get into his entertainment law class. And you say, I called him daily for a week. I plied him with offers to meet the nation's leading conservatives. I invited him to the opera. I got my friend Ben Waldman, who worked for the Reagan administration and had dining privileges at the West Wing, to get him an invitation to eat there daily. Fortunately, my full press was effective, and I got my spot in the seminar. Now, this is unremarked in the story. It's just a happy story about you getting into a kind of class. And I found myself kind of struck that the thing you found corrupt, Bustamante, I was not quite sure of. I mean, here was a congressman working, wasn't giving anybody any money, wasn't doing anything. He was just saying, here's the deal. I'm going to vote for you if you do this political thing for my district. And here was Richard Gordon, my hero Richard Gordon. You're suggesting that he put you in the class because you offered him lunch at the White House. Now, first of all, convince me Richard Gordon didn't get you in the class because of that. But explain to me why the Richard Gordon thing is unproblematic, if it's in fact true, while the Bustamante thing is deeply troubling, or corruption, as you call it.
Well, I hope there were other reasons he let me in the class. I think in the book I wrote about my efforts to get into a class, and as I look back, and I know there are probably some law students here, to think of lobbying to get into a law class is probably not what everybody would have in mind, but I guess that's what I was doing. And you're right, at a certain level, indeed, it is kind of the same problem, where one is bringing extraordinary means and irrelevant benefits to play and to trying to achieve a goal. And I guess what happened, I was 22, 23 perhaps, when, maybe 24, I can't even remember, when I was head of President Reagan's lobby and Congressman Bustamante called me into his office and hit me with this. And I then, as I discuss in the book, I called the White House, was kind of shocked that he would say such a thing, that he would give up 7 votes for a naval base. And I guess I was naive, and the folks at the White House probably thought I was silly calling and even asking that question, and of course they approved it, and Reagan got the MX missile. That's how that vote got through the Congress. And so on the one hand, that was obviously corrupt to me. Yet on the other hand, I kind of blithely went about doing similar things. Probably the distinction I would make in my mind then, and maybe now to some degree, but certainly then, is that as I look back on it, because certainly my whole career became one of using my skills, whatever they were, to lobby, to get public servants, to give outcomes.
Right.
So in this case, he was a public servant, trading, arguably for the benefit of his district, by the way. And I would probably have, in terms of parsing it, viewed my, I was a private citizen, trying to just get ahead. But at the end of the day, I think it is the case that whether one's doing that or one's offering candy to trick kids to come into your store so the parents buy, or whatever one's doing, at some level, there's some bit of corruption there. And the question, I guess, is we have to confront each of these in our daily interactions and decide what level are we willing to play at.
Well, but when you said there was possibly a problem with what Richard Gordon did, you said it was because there was something irrelevant about the gift that was being offered. And I guess...
Well, it wasn't related to the...
It wasn't related to the underlying issue,
right?
And so, but I wonder if that's just not too high a standard to apply in the context of politics. I mean, don't we have to have some politics that we could call non-corrupt, or is just it impossible to imagine democratic politics except with you calling everything corrupt?
No, I don't think everything's corrupt, and okay. I don't think all lobbying's corrupt, by the way. I think lobbying is a good thing. I think lobbying is a cherished right that we have in the Constitution. We have the right to petition our government or to use agents to petition our government or to band together. And that's something we don't want to lose. And I would say that most lobbyists in Washington even and in the state capitals are probably not doing it corruptly. It's where money gets mixed into the lobbying.
Okay, but Bustamante didn't have money on the table.
Well, in a certain way he did. He was delivering, jobs. And I guess what was probably unusual for me, let's just say at that point, was here the horse trading of it all just seemed to be so bizarre. We were trying to convince people. My job at that point was to convince members of Congress to vote for a program, the Amex missile program in this case, because of the merits of it. And I was lobbying on the merits in those days. When I later became a lobbyist, I learned that merits are interesting, but they don't usually win, and unfortunately. But in those days, it was merits. And here was somebody, for the first time in my life, who said that he would give an outcome that I desired for something that had nothing to do with the merits of the MX missile in that case.
Okay. So, but we can certainly agree that when the irrelevant issue is money, campaign contributions, or cash in your pocket. Both of those, I think both of us think, raise troubling problems inside of the system. One striking fact in the book is, I guess when I was looking at this, I was much more charitable in my interpretation of what must be going on inside the system. Your account of the role of money here is not charitable at all. You insist that it's natural that people inside the system, the lobbyists in particular, would expect that they need to be rewarding their benefactors with contributions. And you say there's no question that these contributions have a significant impact on this process, and the impact is not positive. I can tell you we have a department here at Harvard that would question that, but okay, I think you might have an insight stronger than the department with their statisticians. You say, quote, that contributions from parties with an interest in legislation are really nothing but bribes inside of the system, even though these are not for personal gain, they're just for political gain. And most striking to me was the way in which you laid out how the, feels like extortion gets played. You tell this extraordinary story of Tom DeLay meeting with the Microsoft representatives and suggesting that they needed to help out with the Republicans to keep the Republicans in power because the Republicans were more naturally aligned to Microsoft's interests. And then DeLay says, you know, when he was freshman, he says, he told them about approaching Walmart for contributions. And then you quote from you, you said, the government affairs director of Walmart told him that Walmart didn't like to sully their hands with political involvement. And then DeLay, staring intently at the Microsoft executives, continued, quote, a year later, that government affairs rep was in my office asking me to intervene to get an exit build from the federal highway to a new Walmart store. I told him I didn't want to sully my hands with such a task. You know what? They didn't get their ramp. And you know what else? They never will get their ramp. And then DeLay smiled without taking his eyes off the quivering executives from Microsoft. Kind of hard to imagine quivering executives from Microsoft, but there they were. And as we would often say in the lobbying business, they finally got the joke, and a $100,000 check was soon thereafter delivered to the Republican Congressional Committee. Now, from my view, that's extortion, right? That's sending a clear message that you play along or you're not going to get what you need. And you characterize this as just as commonplace as anything inside the system.
Well, unfortunately, DeLay wasn't the only one I witnessed doing stuff like that. Most members of Congress are very subtle. I didn't need to get these speeches from them because I got the joke myself.
Yeah.
You know, when I was lobbying, I was doing everything I could to raise money for everybody I could. I had 40 people working for me, and we raised millions of dollars. But other lobbyists sometimes are a little more obtuse, and they need to be reminded. And so these members of Congress, what they'll do, the standard procedure will be, they'll work with you on an issue. They'll agree to support your bill or oppose whatever you want to oppose. And they'll say, you know, by the way, I'm having a fundraiser next Tuesday. I don't know if you got the invitation to that or not, which means you better come up with some money. If you want me to keep doing this, you better come up with some money. Now, DeLay was known as the hammer.
Yeah.
Okay. And so DeLay didn't mince words sometimes. Even that was a little subtle for DeLay. But DeLay, and he wasn't alone. Eleanor Holmes Norton, who's the delegate for Washington, D.C., was caught infamously on tape actually calling a lobbyist just last year, I think it was, saying that, I don't know if you know this, but I'm chairperson of this committee, and I understand you're coming to our committee for results, and I can't believe I looked at my fundraising list. You're not on the list. Is something wrong with you? Why are you not giving me money? So sometimes it's subtle, and sometimes it's very much out front. It's certainly extortion, and they're soliciting bribes, in essence, is what they're doing.
Yeah.
But it's unfortunately, it's spread throughout the system, whether they're subtle or not.
Now, is it your perception that it was always like that, or it grew during a certain period? Is it any? Do you have a sense? I mean, you wouldn't have experience, but do you have a sense that it's different?
I think it was less subtle, frankly, years ago.
But it's
from the stories when I first started my political career, I knew lobbyists who were senior at that point and were active in the 60s and the 50s, and they said it was less subtle. When LBJ would call you in, there wouldn't be any niceties. Say, where's your $100,000? You know, there'd be members of Congress who said, you want to sit down with me? Come up. Where's the cash? And it wasn't checks, by the way. It wasn't, $2,000 checks. It was $100,000 in cash. Where's your money? So and on the one hand, it was more disgusting, more openly outrageous. And I think today, one of the ways that members of Congress get around feeling horrible about themselves is their subtlety. Is their dissimulation, is trying to make it out to be something other than what it is. Gee, by the way, I'm having a fundraiser next Tuesday night, just in case you happen to be in the room with extra money falling out of your pocket. Having a fundraiser. Yeah. They mean the same thing.
Okay, so they're more subtle. That might make it easier to feel good about themselves. But you also point to them asking for money for things that don't directly benefit them. So, for example, $25,000 for their charity or $50,000 for the Congressional Campaign Committee. Is it your perception that the shift is away from the kind of Blagojevich or the Randy Duke Cunningham type of corruption, which is, you know, what are you going to do for my checking account, personal checking account, and more towards how do we exercise influence for these things that indirectly benefit me but aren't really about me getting a vote?
Well, no, because, you know, the thing is, Randy Cunningham and Blagojevich and William Jefferson and people like that who are, Bob May even, who've got their hand out and want you to actually put cash in there, or we'll give you a menu like Randy Cunningham, Duke Cunningham, but, you know, if you want to have an appetizer, that's going to be $2,000, $100,000. That kind of stuff is rare. But the fact is, these members are not asking for contributions to something they're disinterested in. If it's a charity, oftentimes these charities will pay for their travel, or these charities will hire their wives or their children. If they're asking for money for the Republican or Democratic Congressional Committee, it's because they've been given a requirement by those committees to raise a certain amount of money so they get their chairmanships. There's no, very few are altruistically raising money for, you know, the goodwill industries out there. They're raising money for things that they are involved in. So it's not directly into their bank account, but it might as well be, really.
Right. Okay. And then another dimension of this story that you tell, which is really rich and interesting, is that money, of course, is just one technique that the lobbyists can deploy. Money gifts become another aspect of this kind of money. But, you know, terrifying things to read about. For example, you describe how lobbyists with great influence and certain representatives can actually cause the advent of congressional hearing, and to do so utterly destroy whomever the client wishes to destroy, because the cost of preparing for a hearing could be up to $1 million for this kind of hearing. So this is a kind of weapon that you get to deploy in a way to guarantee that people line up in the way that you want them to line up.
Yeah, I think most people probably don't think about the fact that the government has become a weapon for people. And it's not merely a weapon to go fight wars. It's a weapon to fight wars at home. And lobbyists, and frankly, this was, I'm ashamed to tell you that this was the kind of lobbyist I was. I knew what the deal was. If somebody's called up for a hearing, I'll just give you an idea what a hearing is in the Senate or in the House. People think House and Senate hearings are like trials, and you get a lawyer, and you go up there, and you get a fair hearing, and everything's hunky-dory. It's not. Hearings are kangaroo courts in Congress. Most hearings are designed to achieve a goal that's not ever expressed. And In the sense that lobbyists would push a hearing, it would be for the purpose of putting your opponent, whoever that might be, on defense and setting them back. To prepare properly for a congressional hearing, a hearing that could theoretically land you in prison, by the way, if you perjure yourself, or even if they decide to hold you in contempt of their body, of the House or the Senate, could actually get you, they have a jail cell in the building.
Wow.
That they can put you in. And by the way, when I was called up for my hearing, this was very mindful to me that cell was there. It can destroy your reputation. It can destroy everything you have. But even if it goes well, You're going to spend $1 million preparing for your hearing. You're going to spend weeks and weeks not sleeping preparing for your hearing. You're not going to do anything that might be a problem, meaning anything your opponents might be able to come after you. So one of the great ways to disable your opponent is to organize a hearing. Unfortunately, it's done all the time. There are, 35 standing committees, or I forget what the number was at this point, on the Hill, and they're holding hearings every day. And just multiply that out, and you see how the lobbyist is able to play and how the special interests are able to play in a way that most Americans are just totally unaware of what's going on there.
Mm-hmm. And the people who get called to these hearings, I mean, who pays them to be going to these hearings?
Pays them?
Well, I mean, even like their expenses. I mean, if like an ordinary person from Boston or California.
As a witness for the committee, you mean? Yeah. Somebody who is a tool in the attack?
Yeah.
Sometimes the committee will pay their expenses to get there, most of the time. Uh-huh. Not if they're a target, though.
No. Obviously, if they're not a target, if they're a target.
You can hear great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
I know you're out there. I can feel you now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I don't know the future. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to tell you how it's going to begin. I'm going to hang up this phone, and then I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see. I'm going to show them a world without you. A world without rules and controls, without borders or boundaries. A world where anything is possible. Where we go from there is a choice I leave to you.
More from Great Speeches and Interviews after these messages.